dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank doing Secure Freedom Radio. You know, things have gotten quite lively since President Trump enforced the red line against chemical weapons attacks in Syria. You remember that, don't you? The one President Obama so blithely drew in the sand and then slunk cringing away from when Assad killed hundreds of his own people on his watch? Yeah, well, there are some things we, as the only true superpower, simply cannot tolerate. And using chemical weapons in any way ever is one of them. There are too many tyrants who have them, and if we refuse to lay down the law, then the international treaties and norms against their use will simply blow away like the dust Obama used to draw his faux line in the sand. Like it or not, the United States is the world's policeman. Now, that doesn't mean that we should or even could go anywhere and do anything whenever innocents are being harmed. But it does mean when things get real bad and the world dials 911, the phone rings at the Pentagon. We are the only ones who can even begin to try and maintain some semblance of civilized behavior in a world beset by barbarians and evil. Now, as I said, that is not a call for intervention and nation building and deployment of U.S. troops anytime a bad guy steps out of line. But it is a reminder that if we want to remind the multitude of bad actors out there that there are consequences for bad actions, there's nobody else who can do it. So occasionally stomping a mud hole in one of them is a good way to accomplish that. The French Foreign Legion calls that pour encourager l'autre, to encourage the others. When Syrian air defense showed a deluge of tomahawks inbound, the weak knees of Bashar al-Assad had to be knocking like maracas. His Russian advisors were likely telling him they were only aimed at destroying some of his toys in an airfield out in the desert, but it's not hard for him to imagine that the next round could easily come without a warning and flatten his presidential palace. And we all know, rubble don't make trouble. This was also literally a shot across the bow of Vlad the Impaler Putin. Kind of hard to make the case that Trump is Putin's puppet now when he's blowing up the air force of Putin's actual puppet, Assad. And now Trump is sending Secretary of State Tillerson to Moscow with evidence that we know Russia was complicit in the Syrian chemical attacks that precipitated all of this. You know, there's one constant in the game of geostrategic power that a Barack Obama, the world's most successful beta male, was fundamentally incapable of understanding and therefore exercising. Peace comes from strength, not weakness. You can't make evildoers like you just because you send them gifts or reset buttons or say nice things about them in flowery speeches. The only way to make sure they don't do the evil that lies in their hearts is to make sure there is a healthy dose of fear in there, too, to outweigh their bad instincts and base desires. That has been sorely missing for the past 8 years, and consequently, the tyrants of the world have been on the march. ISIS took advantage of the vacuum Obama created when he cut and ran from Iraq, rather than stay and midwife the nascent democracy we spent blood and treasure to create. Assad ran rampant against the forces trying to overthrow him. We led from behind in Libya. We stood on the sidelines while Putin took Crimea and moved into Ukraine. We followed another one of Obama's absurd naming conventions of strategic patience while North Korea lobbed missiles closer and closer to our shores, and we watched the Chinese steal large chunks of the water around them in a maritime imperial power grab. Weakness emboldens tyrants. And we had a truly weak man in Barack Obama running our country, and therefore not running the defenses of the free world. You know, it may destabilize things for the short term, but it's a necessary step to reestablishing the proper order of things. And that is, tyrants and dictators of the world, you make the United States mad at your own peril. I've often joked, and to be honest, if I thought this could actually happen, I would be all for it, that the president should end the State of the Union speech each year by spinning the Wheel of Woe. You know, one of those actual carnival-style big ticker wheels that has the names of all the biggest bad guys of the past 12 months in wedges based on just how big a problem each one of them has been. Then when he finishes up his speech, the president spins the wheel, and whoever's name it lands on wins the prize, which is a rain of hellfire or tomahawks down on them. You could have a big red button pop up out of the podium, and then the commander-in-chief hits it, and the live feed to all over the world goes to the deck of whichever ship does the launch. You know, so we get that pretty shot of the flaming ascent high into the sky. Then it shifts to the nose cone of one of those missiles as it goes screaming back to Earth and sends a deserving collection of scumbags on their way to hell. You could sell sponsorships to the various defense contractors. This year's State of the Union is brought to you by Raytheon, manufacturer of the Tomahawk cruise missile, Boeing, who brings us the Apache attack helicopter, and Lockheed Martin for the Hellfire missile. But the point is, the best way to deter bad guys from being bad is to make being bad a bad thing for them. It's not a guarantee that they'll stop. I mean, part of the makeup of most tyrants is a sociopathic nature that certainly doesn't follow rational decision-making processes. I mean, take the Kims, for example. They've been torturing the people of North Korea for decades, and nobody yet has found a way to stop them. But what it will do is affect enough of them. And that makes the truly bat guano crazy ones just higher priorities for a top spot when we spin the Wheel of Woe. Then we can get back to the much more enjoyable practice of diplomacy, with a bunch of folks sipping mint tea and nibbling petit fours down by the pool. This can actually only be effective when it is backed up by a credible threat of force for any of the principals who step over established lines of decency. It's the carrot cake or the hammer of Thor. And as von Clausewitz said in his weighty tome, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. So they can either make a deal and seal it with a fine Dom Perignon at a swanky hotel in Paris, or keep wondering what that buzzing sound over their head is right up until impact and their return to their component molecules. I think quite a few of them will say, I'll take not getting blown to smithereens for $2 billion, Alex. We need to make sure all of our national security and foreign policy apparatus works together, like an iron fist in a velvet glove. We have the world's most powerful military, and its primary function is to stop bad things from happening. Now, if we want to get fancy, then we can start coordinating our economic might into the equation as well. You know, back to that choice of carrot cake or hammer of Thor. Play nice with us, and we all benefit. Step over the line and get squashed like a bug. I'm Jim Hansen, and if you're enjoying this, you might like my Twitter feed, which you can find at @uncle_Jimbo. I give them a little bit of this every day. Up next after the break, we're going to talk with Gordon Chang about China and North Korea, then Bill Gertz about Russian information warfare, and we'll wrap this show up with Steve Bucci from Heritage talking about Syria, Iraq, and what in the world is going to happen when ISIS is toppled and somebody's got to govern that mess. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. We'll be back after the break.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Gordon Chang, who is the duty expert for the Pacific Rim and author of The Coming Collapse of China, as well as Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. And Gordon, I gotta say, both of your books seem to be particularly apt given the events going on right now in that particular region. Over the weekend, it seems that President Trump actually turned around a carrier group that was heading for Australia to do a little bit of resting and refitting and steamed them into the Sea of Japan, basically to make sure that the current Kim didn't do anything particularly crazy, which unfortunately seems to be his normal mode. So give us a little bit more detail about what the implications of that are for all of us.
Sending the Carl Vinson back to the Korean Peninsula, because it was there before it went to Singapore, is a message, of course, to the North Koreans. It's a deterrence issue, but it's also a message to China. Now, Pacific Command is sending the carrier strike group into the Sea of Japan, which is the east side of the Korean Peninsula. That's away from China. This reminds us of 2010, after the North Koreans sunk the Chonan, a South Korean frigate, which resulted in the loss of 46 lives. We wanted to send the George Washington, another Nimitz-class carrier, into the Yellow Sea as a message of deterrence. China was enraged. We didn't do it in deference to Beijing. And after we didn't do it, the North Koreans reached out and killed four more South Koreans by shelling that island. I think that Trump sending the carrier onto the east side of the coast is saying to China, look, we want to cooperate with you. But if you're not going to cooperate with us, the next time a Nimitz carrier is in the vicinity, it's going to be in the Yellow Sea where you just don't want it.
Now, that's interesting because, you know, by all public appearances, the meeting here between the Chinese president and President Trump went fairly well. But with what Kim's been doing, with the lobbing of missiles towards Japan, with what appear to be, again, potential for another nuclear test, obviously that's still a problem. Is it that China doesn't have the control over them anymore?
Well, China can control North Korea. It just doesn't want to. So, for instance, we know that about 90% of the North's external commerce is with China. China accounts for something almost like 100% of North Korea's crude oil. It does account for 100% of its jet fuel, which means that there'd be no North Korean Air Force without Beijing. But Beijing doesn't want to exercise that power for various reasons, and some of them are essentially to give the United States a hard time. So I think that essentially Beijing is going to be difficult on North Korea, despite the smiles of the Mar-a-Lago get-together. And as Trump said in his Financial Times interview of about a week ago, this is something that if the Chinese don't help, we're going to do it alone, and we can fix this. And the word he used was totally. We can totally fix this.
You know, President Trump is sometimes prone to hyperbolic rhetoric. And I understand that, you know, it serves a purpose. But what in the world would be totally fixing North Korea? I mean, the Kims have been running that place, not even into the ground, below the ground, through the Earth's core, you know, beyond belief. It's a hellhole on a good day. And one that threatens the rest of the world with its, you know, nuclear programs and ballistic missile programs and the rest. Is there any way we could legitimately take them out and leave something behind that wasn't, you know, a bunch of North Korean generals scrambling to gather all the weapons of mass destruction each one of them could?
There are two things that we could do. First of all, there is the military option, but we're not going to do that for various reasons, including the fact that 25 million South Koreans live in their capital, which is just 30 miles from the demilitarized zone, which separates the two Koreas. And North Korea's army, which is the world's fourth largest, is forward deployed on the DMZ. But there is something that we can do, which is not kinetic, and that is that we can actually start unplugging Chinese banks from the global financial system, because they have been helping North Korea's illicit programs and have been involved in its illicit commerce. That would force Beijing to do something, to use its powers to deal with North Korea effectively. As I mentioned, China doesn't want to do that, but we've never imposed costs on China for its support of North Korea's ballistic missile program, its nuclear weapons program, and all of the other things that it does to destabilize the international system. So if we start to impose severe costs on the Chinese, we actually may be able to solve this totally on our own.
Okay, let's go to the China side of this equation. And as you mentioned, they, without their support, there is no North Korea. So if we make the threat or the actuality of, in some ways, cutting off their banking capability to support that, does that play into President Trump's concerns about Chinese currency manipulation and the rest of the things that go on? I mean, can that be a balance, a lever, a way to use both of those together and say you need to play nice in, on a couple fronts, and we don't want military problems, so the pressure I'm going to use to force you to the table is going to be financial? Is that a way he could make that happen?
Well, I think that if President Trump shows some political will on any of these issues, such as the Chinese banks participating in North Korea's programs, if he demonstrates political will, then I think that he probably can push the Chinese in better directions on all of the other issues that we have, such as Taiwan, South China Sea, predatory trade problems, all the rest of it. But it's going to be difficult. If I were President Trump at Mar-a-Lago over last week, I just would have said that this is not a negotiation anymore. We're just not in it to talk to you. We're telling you what you're going to do. And if you don't do it, this is what I'm going to do. You know, Bank of China, which is one of your big four banks, it was mentioned in the UN's panel of experts report on UN sanctions, how Bank of China is a bad actor. Well, Bank of China is no longer going to be able to deal in dollars anymore. And I suppose that once Trump unplugs one Chinese bank, that everything else is going to fall into line. It's going to be difficult. There's a lot of downsides to this, of course. But the point is, we have never really taken that approach with the Chinese. And until we do that, they're just not going to believe us. As Arthur Waldron of the University of Pennsylvania says, we have taught the Chinese to ignore our warnings. And that's our fault.
Do you think that there's the possibility that making those major actions, you know, taking big actions against Chinese banking, do they have an out? Can they use the rest of the world against us, or is it really too big a hill for them to climb?
I think it's too big a hill for them to climb, because everybody needs to clear dollars or to do transactions in dollars. You know, this would rock global markets because, you know, we're obviously using our financial leverage. But on the other hand, we need to do something, because the North Koreans are within 4 years or so of being able to put a nuclear weapon on a long-range missile and hit the lower 48 states. They already got the missiles to hit the lower 48 states. They just can't mate the nuke. So we don't have very much time to figure this out. Through relentlessly pursuing misguided policies, we have put ourselves into a deep hole. So we've got to do something. And no solution going forward is going to be perfect by any means. Almost all the solutions are horrible, but we've got to do something.
What would be horrible is a North Korean missile with a small nuclear weapon on it hitting the United States, or anywhere for that matter. Do we take that big risk now to avoid the possibility of the greater risk later? Would you recommend that to President Trump?
Yes. Well, you know, for no other reason, I mean, regardless of what our North Korea policy preferences are, we cannot allow anyone to abuse the U.S. financial system, to launder money through U.S. accounts for the purpose of helping North Korea. I mean, it's just completely unacceptable. And I think that if Trump is not willing to sanction Chinese banks, then he needs to go before the American public and say, I am seeking the repeal of U.S. money laundering laws because I'm intimidated by the Chinese. We need to enforce U.S. law. No one launders money through the U.S. banking system, and especially not for North Korea.
Folks, that's good advice for President Trump coming from Gordon Chang. Up next, we're going to talk with Bill Gertz from The Washington Times.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Right now, we are talking with Bill Gertz, who is senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, as well as Inside the Ring columnist at the Washington Times, and the author of the book, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Now, Bill, obviously, information warfare has been an issue throughout the election and now into President Trump's term. And most people seem to be highly focused on the Russians and what they may or may not have done. I think it's fair to say they were meddling, as they have been for a long time, in our election and with the information flow. Do you see an increase in that? Is this a major change to their game, or is it just that they now have the ability through online means to have a broader and, you know, more effective way to do that?
First of all, hi, Jim. Good to be on the show. Yeah, the Russians have stepped up their game as far as the use of information warfare elements, especially targeting the United States. It's not a new phenomena, but one of the things they've done is they've created an entire new force within their military that's dedicated to conducting information warfare operations. So they recognize that it's a asymmetric tool that can be exploited to achieve strategic goals. The problem is that we in the West are only beginning to understand this threat, and we haven't done enough to try and counter it. We know that the Secretary of State is heading to Moscow this week. That should be interesting. Trump seemed to have a blind spot on Russia early on in his administration. That seems to have changed with the Syrian strike, which certainly angered the Russians, who are protecting their patron in Damascus. So it's a new form of conflict. And like I say, the goal there is to achieve strategic aims without resorting to conventional force and or on the higher end, even nuclear forces or threats of nuclear force.
We seem to be back into the conventional, you know, clash of whether or not they're a superpower or not, clash of the major powers in the world. When President Trump now, who obviously at this point doesn't appear to be Putin's puppet, has flattened an airfield that was used for a chemical attack against the Syrian people. And now we're told, is, as you mentioned, is sending Secretary of State Tillerson there to Moscow, along with his British counterpart, with what we're told is evidence of Russian collusion, or at least, you know, complicity in that chemical attack. That's slightly ominous, in my view. Is that as bad as it could be?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, that would be interesting to see what the information was that they have linking the Russians to the Syrian chemical attack. But clearly, if that's the case, then I think the information that I've heard so far in press reports has been that there was indications that Russians were working at that airfield. That airfield was used to launch the chemical strike that killed the civilians. And obviously the Russians have swung into high gear on the disinformation front. They're denying that, and we're seeing that play out in their propaganda tools. So this is kind of a case study in how the Russians are using kind of hybrid warfare to support nefarious activities, and then also using information operations to fool the world opinion.
You know, Bill, I fought in the Cold War, and this feels an awful lot like that same game. We've got full-on information and propaganda operations. We've got proxies fighting proxies. You know, we're battling it out that way. I hope that this, you know, doesn't escalate, but I don't see how President Trump can avoid confronting them.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting there. It does have overtones of the Cold War. I noticed on Twitter that Alexander Dugin, who is considered Putin's ideologist, he has written a big article which called the U.S. strike on the Syrian airfield as the first battle of World War III. So we're starting to hear that rhetoric come out from both the U.S. and from Russia. So it's certainly interesting to see how this will play out. Obviously, it's kind of a low-level warfare. And again, Syria is the battlefield for this, where this is playing out. And then, of course, you add the Iranians into that, which are also supporting the Assad regime and trying to take over Iraq. And it gets even more complicated.
Let's shift gears to another terrifying prospect, and we seem to be awash in them. The North Koreans have been not just rattling sabers, but lobbing missiles into the ocean and prepping for potentially more nuclear tests. And, you know, it appears that whatever came out of the summit between President Trump and the Chinese leader was not a solution to that problem. What is, in addition, going on there?
Yeah, we have not heard a lot about what went on at the summit between Trump and Xi Jinping about North Korea. We know that Trump had made clear that he was going to press the Chinese leader and tell them, look, you've got to rein in this rogue regime or we're going to do it. The latest step is that the U.S. is moving the carrier strike group led by the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson over to the waters near North Korea. That's certainly an ominous sign. I think the United States has completed a policy review. We don't have the details of that policy review, but clearly the Trump administration appears to be gearing up for some type of either saber rattling or perhaps even some type of show of force against the North Koreans to try and pressure that regime into stopping its provocative actions.
And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of faith that anything rational is going to come in response from the North Korean leader. But that, I guess, is the point of working through, you know, the regime that owns North Korea, being the Chinese, and hoping they can provide at least the lever of cutting off their food and oil and the other things that run that place. But seems to be just another place where we need a solution and we don't really have an option, because leading from behind, or I guess as the policy for North Korea was called, strategic patience, seems to have led to simply more problems.
Yeah, I think the real danger is that there's some new intelligence out saying that the North Koreans within the next few years are going to be able to have a long-range missile with a nuclear warhead capable of ranging the United States. So I think that's kind of driving the Trump administration's policy. You add to that the fact that the Secretary of State, Tillerson, has recently said that the threat posed by North Korea is imminent, which in diplomatic terminology is certainly a dire warning. When something's labeled an imminent threat, it carries very serious strategic meaning. So things are heating up over in that part of the world for sure.
The Iranians have always been the other wild card here. Is there a possibility that, you know, they may rear their ugly head in the context of working with the Russians and working with the North Koreans on weapons of mass destruction?
Clearly, I think the entire Iranian nuclear deal that was done by the Obama administration is a dangerous agreement that's clearing the way. It's actually facilitating Iran developing nuclear weapons in 10 years or less. The real danger I see in Iran is that they are working to take over Saudi Arabia, and they're doing it in a very serious way. They have control of the Strait of Hormuz. They're working to do another choke point in the Red Sea, the Bab al-Mandab, and they're really targeting the Saudi regime as well. And that's mostly evident in their support of the Yemeni rebels, which is an ongoing battle there. The Saudis are having a tough fight to try and defeat those Iranian-backed rebels. We're seeing the use of suicide explosive boats that are remotely piloted. So I think the Iranian problem, and then of course if you look at Iran's effort to try and take over Iraq, those two places are a real serious problem.
Yeah, it's a giant globe of doom right now, and the one thing that gives me hope is at least President Trump is standing firm as opposed to cringing, and that actually matters when you're dealing with tyrants. Bill Gertz, author of iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age, thanks for joining us. Up next, we'll be talking with Steve Bucci of the Heritage Foundation.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank, and we're talking right now with Steve Bucci, director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Now, Steve, obviously there are so many flare-ups around the globe right now that some things that absolutely shouldn't be ignored aren't getting the coverage they need, and one of those is the attacks on Palm Sunday against Egyptian Coptic Christians, a couple of horrifying suicide bombings and dozens of people killed, hundreds wounded. Give us a little bit of the background around that.
Well, you know, ISIS is very active now within Egypt. That's one of the places they flared up after they started getting more and more pressure in Syria and Iraq. And President al-Sisi he's trying to fight them. I mean, he sees it as a individual national interest, but he also sees it as a wider one, and we're still a little slow in getting them some help. But this attack this weekend shows ISIS is deliberately targeting Christian Arabs and around the world, and really to devastating effect.
Now, President al-Sisi was just here, met with President Trump. They discussed a lot of things. One thing that was not discussed, or at least mentioned particularly prominently, was the Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Sisi came into power by deposing the Brotherhood and pointing out that they have, in his country for certain, not stopped their terrorist tendencies. Do you think that they are complicit with ISIS, or is it even possible that ISIS was operating without their knowledge or consent?
Well, I mean, President al-Sisi has really kind of put a hurt on the Brotherhood there in Egypt, fortunately for the Egyptian people. So I'm not sure how much they're helping ISIS, but they're definitely fellow travelers. They have similar ideologies. They really don't like the direction that of democratization that Egypt is at least trying to take some nascent steps. They loved using democracy to get into power, but then as soon as they got in there, they were going to throw the whole thing in the can and pursue their own ends. So there's probably at least an sort of fellow traveler kind of connection. I don't know if they're operating together or not, but it's something worth looking into.
Yeah, those two making common cause would be a headache al-Sisi doesn't need and the world doesn't need. That's bad for everyone and horrible for the Christians who are being persecuted and killed there and elsewhere by ISIS and the rest of the Islamists. Steve, let's jump to Syria, where they've actually run most of the Christians out, and talk about the chemical attacks and President Trump's response to those. Which it seems he gave a warning to the Russians and Syrians, I think wisely, to avoid potentially broadening the conflict and including the Russians. But do you think that we're now in a more aggressive, antagonistic posture towards the Russians, given their apparent either complicity or blind eye they turned to this?
Well, I think at the very least, President Trump has sent a very strong message, not just to Bashar al-Assad, but to Vladimir Putin, to even Kim Jong-un and the Ayatollahs in Tehran, that, hey, I'm not Barack Obama. And if you guys go beyond the pale, I'm going to take some action. Now, there's a lot of debate as to whether the action was the right one, should have been bigger, should have been less. But he is not going to sit on his hands and wait for permission from somebody like Russia before he takes action in a place like Syria. So while I'm the jury's still out on the effectiveness of the move and from a tactical sense in Syria, from a messaging standpoint, it was powerful and I think will have some good effect.
You know, in the opening segment of the show, I mentioned the French Foreign Legion has a phrase they use when trying to influence people called pour encourager les autres, to encourage the others. So when you stomp a mud hole in someone like Assad, the rest of them have to pay attention and wonder, you know, am I next? What is it? You know, where is the red line? Because there obviously is one now, as opposed to an imaginary one during the Obama administration. So now you mentioned, though, did it work or did it not? Let's dig a little bit into what happens in both Syria and Iraq, because we're nearing, if not an end game, at least we should be planning for next steps if the caliphate is toppled. If we cut down the black flag in Iraq and Syria and ISIS isn't running things, who can? You know, the Iranians seem to be highly influencing the Iraqi government. The Syrians are a puppet regime that doesn't even control their own country. Who can run any of that if we manage to knock ISIS off its perch?
That's the problem. If ISIS goes, it's less of an issue because you have theoretically two governments there that supposedly will fill that gap. Unfortunately, there one is a bad government in Syria, and the other one is a weak and badly influenced government in Iraq. To be honest with you, one of the bigger problems is what happens if you get rid of Assad, who needs to go. He's a horrendous dictator and just terrible person. But if he goes, who wins the Syrian civil war part two? Right now, it could be ISIS. It could be Al-Qaeda. It could be the Muslim Brotherhood. This is there's not a lot of really good options there. And that's the difficult part that the Trump administration needs to work out and come to a conclusion as to where they want to go, not just let it go to chance the way the Obama administration did.
Yeah, we can't sit on the sidelines. Okay, I will throw you my cunning plan for this, which we actually wrote almost a year and a half ago in the book Cut Down the Black Flag, and it ended in essentially a partition along sectarian lines. You know, the countries of Syria and Iraq are artificial. They were drawn on a map in post-colonial times or in the colonial breakup, so there's no coherence to it other than, you know, the fact that they've been there. You've got Shia, who are now increasing, you know, in Iraq, around Baghdad and farther, who are increasingly allied with Iran. You've got the Sunni tribes from Anbar into Syria, which now have been, you know, more or less dominated and oppressed by ISIS, but if at some point are going to leave there. And we at one point had fairly cordial relations with the Sunni tribal leaders. I don't know if any of them are still alive, but some potentially. And then you've got over towards the coast in Syria, you've got Assad and his minorities, you know, the Alawites and the other minorities over there. Why in the world don't we tell the UN, let's redraw the map and give self-determination to these and throw it in their lap?
I'm not real thrilled about throwing anything in the UN's lap because I don't think they're competent to deal with it, nor would they necessarily come up with a solution that we'd be thrilled with. They tend to flow with some of the folks that we dislike the most.
That's true.
But you're right from the standpoint of we've got to look out of the box. We've got to look for a different kind of solution because looking at the standard ones, the return to the status quo just is unsat right now. It's not going to work, and we need to start thinking that way. You know, John Kerry was abysmal at doing this. His lack of imagination and lack of spine was just legion. And now with Secretary of State Tillerson, Secretary of Defense Mattis, and President Trump, I think we got a team in there that could actually come up with some good solutions. Some of the stuff you've talked about, I think, is going to end up being a part of it, which means there's going to be people that are going to be unhappy. But right now, we need to look for our national interests and the security of our friends in the region, because right now it's just too volatile. And there's people suffering because of a lack of decision making on the part of the countries who have the ability to influence it.
That's a fact. Steve Bucci, director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for being with us. This is Jim Hansen, and that is going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.